This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. I'm Dr. PJ Thumb and I'm a historian at the University of Oxford. And this is the history of Singapore. Episode 6, Modernist Islam, Malay Islam and Malayan Nationalism. This episode is a little different from usual. It's an interview with Dr. Fadila Yahya, who is an expert on the history of the Arab and Muslim community in Singapore. We will be talking to her about modernist Islam, or the Islamic Reform Movement, which came to Singapore in the early 1900s and is one of the most important threads of Malayan nationalism. In the first part, we discuss the broader picture of pan-Islam in maritime Southeast Asia, and especially in the Dutch East Indies. We are recording at the European Association of Southeast Asian Studies Conference in Vienna, Austria. So a warm welcome, bienvenue, assalamualaikum, and selamat datang to all my listeners. We are really honored to have with us today Dr. Fadila Yahya, who is a research fellow at the Asia Research Institute of the National University of Singapore. Dr. Fadila got her PhD from Princeton and was later a postdoc at the University of Washington in St. Louis. Welcome, Fadila.
Thanks for having me.
You're our very first guest, so we're very excited.
I'm truly honored.
The honor is all mine. Why don't we start with, why don't you tell us about your work? What exactly is your work about?
Sure. So my work is about the Arab diaspora in Southeast Asia. And I look at how the British and the Dutch colonial administration implemented and administered Islamic law and applied it to the Arabs in the Dutch East Indies, which is now Indonesia, British Malaya and Singapore. So basically the British Strait Settlements and also British Malaya. And I look at how these Arabs themselves negotiated with the Dutch and British colonial elite in order to get whatever they wanted in the realm of law. And I started this project 6 years ago thinking that because they were highly mobile, they were able to forum shop, as in, if they couldn't get whatever they wanted in a Dutch court in, say, Batavia or Surabaya or Palembang, they would go to another court somewhere else in the Dutch colony or in Singapore or Penang or Malacca. What I found was that during the late 19th and early 20th centuries, right up till the Second World War, right up till the Japanese occupation of Southeast Asia, they were not able to do so or did not want to do so. My PhD dissertation asked the question, why didn't they or why couldn't they? So it came to the Arabs living in the Netherlands Indies, they could not. They faced difficulty moving from place to place because the Dutch imposed quarter and pass system during that period, especially from 1901 onwards. It became really hard for them to even move out of their particular city. You know, if they were in Surabaya, it's really hard for them to move out of that city itself to go to another city within the Netherlands Indies.
Was this part of the ethical system that was introduced about this time?
It was related to the ethical system, but somewhat separate. The Arabs, even though they were lumped together with the Chinese and the Japanese, they were linked to the native population, in the sense that they married local Indonesians way more than the Chinese and the Japanese did. And so, you know, the fact that they were Muslims was a huge factor in a Dutch suspicion of this entire community. They were suspected of being proponents of pan-Islamism, which we know now to be mostly untrue. But at the time, the fear that the Dutch felt towards them was real, was very much palpable and played out in very real ways. One of these ways was the one that I just described to you, the quarter and pass system.
Why were the Dutch so afraid of pan-Islam?
Because they had a huge colony which were formed, most of the colonial subjects were Muslims. And they had this idea that these local Muslims, who were mostly Javanese in the Netherlands Indies, were susceptible to influence by these Arabs. They viewed this hierarchy within the Netherlands Indies with great derision, as, you know, resting on superstition, on some kind of ancient hierarchy where descendants of the prophet were at the top, for example, and Arabs being closer to the origin of Islam as being holy and saintly and therefore natural leaders. They were very worried about this development and kept an eye on these Arabs as a result, especially those who identified as being descendants of the prophet.
But how real is pan-Islam in this period? Is there actually a strong regional Islamic identity, or do people's own local geographical or ethnic identities take precedence?
I must say that there was a strong pan-Islamic identity, not just in Southeast Asia, but throughout the Indian Ocean as well. The point of confluence would be the Hajj, annual pilgrimage to Makkah that all Muslims are encouraged to do within their lifetime. And because of this annual congregation that takes place in a place that was cut off from non-Muslim contact, such that the British and the Dutch felt like they were cut off from, you know, a party that everybody's going to, but they were not privy to. And so I think it created a sense of paranoia. And based on my research of Malay and Arabic periodicals that were circulating in the Indian Ocean, there seemed to be a strong, distinct sense of a pan-Islamic identity that was surging from the late 19th century onwards, from the 1880s onwards, way up till now, you know. So it's not like there wasn't a sense of common identity amongst Muslims. Some of these manifestations of a pan-Islamic identity took the form of anti-colonial rhetoric. And some, even East Africa, for example, even went the way of uprisings. And this created a lot of fear, not just amongst Dutch colonial elite, but also the British and the French and the Italians. And they conducted joint surveillance efforts in order to identify who these proponents, who the strongest proponents of pan-Islamism are. So pan-Islamism was linked to anti-colonial ideology and possibly seditious acts of violence. Now we know that was mostly paranoia on the part of European colonial administrations. But at the time, they either did not know or were playing it up. I'm not sure, but that was the case. At the same time, ethnic and nationalist ideologies were also on the rise, especially from the 1920s onwards, after the First World War. During the interwar period, it was quite strong. And this sort of Kumbaya pan-Islamic moment from the 1880s till the 1920s slowly started to give way to rifts within Muslim communities within Southeast Asia. In Singapore, it was particularly stark, despite the small Muslim community in Singapore, you know, in terms of numbers, in terms of proportion. The Muslim reformist movements were mostly aided by people of Arab and Indian descent. There were also Malays and Javanese and Minangkabaus, but the Indians and the Arabs were very prominent, and they identified with these movements, and slowly it seems that these movements were becoming ethnicized, and there was a mushroom of reformist movements, and people of Indian and Arab descent started to become more prominent in terms of their identity as being foreigners, even though they had been in the region for centuries, or, you know, so it didn't matter anymore. You know, that foreign aspect of their identity was suddenly became a thing, suddenly became a problem.
After the break, we talk more about how the modernist Islamic movement transformed the Malay and Muslim community in Singapore. BFM 89.9. Welcome back. The Islamic reform movement transformed Singapore in the early 20th century. Over 100 years ago, the Malay and Muslim community in Singapore was very different. Fundamentally, being Malay and Muslim were not necessarily the same thing. Malay generally referred to the Bahasa-speaking pre-Bumi people of maritime Southeast Asia. In Singapore, they were divided by place of origin, the Javanese, the Boyanese, the Bugis, and so on. While most were Muslim, there were also Christians and those who practiced traditional animist religions. Then, there were the Arabs, who were far, far fewer in number, but far richer. They were Muslim, but held themselves separate from the rest of the community. They thought themselves better, richer, superior. There were South Asian Muslims and the Jawi Peranakan, who were the product of intermarriage between South Asian Muslims and local Malay Muslims. They too were richer, although perhaps not as rich as the Arabs, and regarded themselves as superior to the rest of the Muslim community. So the Muslim community is divided by class and wealth. And of course, there is a diversity in how Islam is practiced. The Arabs practice Arabic forms of Islam, and the local Malays practice local forms of Islam with local traditions and cultures, or adat. For example, in the 15th century, the Malacca Empire developed a code of international shipping law, Undang-Undang Laut Malacca, and a civil and commercial code, Undang-Undang Malacca, which was heavily Islamic but had extensive adat influences to deal with local issues. These codes would later spread across the region and become the legal source for local jurisprudence in major regional sultanates like Brunei, Patani, Aceh, and of course, Johor. So this is the scene in Singapore as we approach the end of the 19th century. And this is where we return to our conversation with Dr. Fadila Yahya.
What is Singapore like before the rise of the reform movements, before the rise of all these different ideologies which you've mentioned? In the mid-19th century, how would you characterize the Muslim / Malay community in Southeast Asia? Those are not necessarily the same thing, right?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So from the middle of the 19th century onwards, there was a clear trend in that the wealthiest Muslim colonial subjects in Singapore and the other two Straits settlements of Penang and Malacca were mostly Indian Muslims and Arabs. And we could identify them by name because they have distinct names, especially the Arabs had clan names and were very much proud of their Arab identity and crisscrossed the Indian Ocean and, you know, maintained a distinct Arab identity despite frequent intermarriage with local women. And the same goes for South Asians, who were more diverse. Arabs tended to come from just one place in Yemen, in Hadramaut, on the coast of Yemen. South Asians came from all over South Asia. There were Tamils, there were Gujaratis, Punjabis, Bengalis, and they also tended to cluster together and marry each other. There were more of them, so they were able to keep their Indianness. They were more able to keep their Indianness. That being said, the Arabs, you know, most of the people who came from Hadramaut were men, and they married local women, but were still able to keep their patrilineal clans, simply because it was patrilineal.
Right.
And they started to establish endowments consisting of property, landed property, real estate, known as wakafs, of which there are many today in Singapore, but significantly less than before. And so they were very prominent within the Singaporean landscape because a lot of their property was tied up in these wakfs. And these wakfs were very prominent. They are located in old Singapore, in the city center today.
Okay.
So even, you know, today you can see where they are, you know, in Arab Street. They used to own vast amounts of property on Orchard Road, for example. Right. The Asagaf clan owned a plantation there in Orchard Road. And so, you know, these Arabs and Indian Muslims led very prominent lives in Singapore. From there, we could already see that there was economic stratification, which was very much tied to ethnicity. And in the records that I see, both in the colonial office and also law reports, Arabs and Indian Muslims, although they were very few of them, Arabs only consisted less than 1% of the entire subject population in Singapore. Consistently from the late 18, you know, from the time when censuses began, they held property amounting to more than 30% of property not already owned by the British colonial elite.
I see.
So that's, you know, that's a very, very stark contrast to the rest of the Muslim subject population who did not have access to this sort of wealth.
Now, but who would the Muslim population or the Malay population look up to for leadership in this period?
Yeah.
Because with the former Temenggong, now the Sultan of Johor, having moved across the river to Tanjung Puteri, and leaving behind this political vacuum in Singapore, who leads the Malay/Muslim community?
Yeah, that is a very difficult question to answer because the Malays themselves were very diverse. And we still haven't defined properly who is a Malay. You know, this term Malay is so fluid and no one has defined convincingly or no one has ever thought it useful enough to demarcate as to who a Malay is for all kinds of reasons in both Malaysia and Singapore. So it's hard to... The Malay community is so diverse, and they moved in and out of Singapore, you know, so it's hard to say who the Malays looked up to when the Temenggong crossed over to Johor. That being said, because the Arabs and Indian Muslims established endowments known as wakafs in Singapore, which consisted of mosques, madrasas, religious schools, cemeteries, medical dispensaries, hospitals, they filled that niche somewhat. Right.
For social welfare.
Yeah. And these men who were the philanthropists were taxpayers as well and often sat on many, you know, boards and municipal boards and were also justices of the peace and stuff like that. So they were, it seemed that they were propped up. I can say that they were definitely regarded as leaders of the Muslim community by the British.
Right.
Whereas, you know, I'm not sure if the Malays, looked up to them. You know what I mean? Because but I can definitely tell you that the British regarded them as the leaders of the Muslim community. The Sultan of Johor, I mean, from the Temenggong line in Singapore, was, not surprisingly, very good friends with the Arab community in Singapore. And they socialized together and also were in business together. For example, the Asagaf patriarch, Syed Muhammad Asagaf, was granted a huge concession by the Sultan of Johor sometime in the 1880s, if I'm not wrong. Might even be earlier than that. To establish a plantation on Kukup Island. And there was some controversy about this Kukup plantation it's off the coast of Johor. Because Javanese indentured workers were found to be maltreated on this island, and the British court got involved and there was a legal case about it and stuff like that. So that's how we know that the island was actually a gift from the Sultan of Johor, who actually spent a lot of time in Singapore, it seems, more so than on the peninsula, fraternized with the British colonial elite and stuff like that, hung out in hotels.
So let's go back to these different ideological forces that are transforming the community, which you mentioned, pan-Islam, nationalism. When do these start to arise in Singapore and why, you know, why do they first appear?
So this sort of, it is a very complicated process in the 20s and 30s. It has not been studied enough, especially when it comes to Malaya in Singapore. The reformist movements in Indonesia have been more widely studied by scholars. Singapore and Malaya, not so much. So the center of this movement was, as you said, Singapore. And it is a very complex society at this point in time. There were rifts starting to be shown. And one of the things that was attacked is this sort of homage that was paid to descendants of the Prophet. So Muslim reformers found it to be, you know, archaic and backward, and they used words like that, and not enlightened, irrational. And these reformist movements were trying to attack that very thing, you know, the lack of rationality when it comes to practices, Muslim practices in the region, rife with superstition. And they saw this sort of undue respect paid to the descendants of prophets being part of that as well. So bound up together. And also, in tandem with this, with the rise of ethnic nationalism, in that, you know, who is a Malay began to be, you know, this question of who a Malay is began to be discussed. Someone of Indian descent, can he be considered a Malay? Someone of Arab descent, can he be considered a Malay? If you have a Malay father and an Indian mother, does that make you more Malay than if you have an Indian father and a Malay mother? And all these things, you know, were publicly discussed, and you know, it became very unpleasant and quite ugly when certain prominent personalities were you know, racial slurs could be hurled at them, and these racial slurs could be something as could sound something as innocuous as you know, Dara Keturunan Arab, which means someone of Arab descent, and the acronym for that is DKA, and DKA became a slur, you know.
Just like
and you know, the other slur, which is more of a slur, in a more obvious way, is Dara Keturunan Keling, DKK, which is hurled at people of which is aimed at people of Indian descent, no matter if they're North Indian or South Indian, it seems. And you know, it became really ugly because you know, it could be just that, you know, being of Indian or Arab descent could make you could discredit you as someone who could speak for the Muslim community.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, we know that, basically the reform movement came to Singapore through returnees from the Hajj.
Yes, mostly.
Right? What would be the rest of it? Where else would you say it came from?
So, the proponents, I would say, would be returnees from the Hajj, but once these ideas circulate within the Indo-Malay archipelago, it would just be people who might not have even gone for the Hajj, but have imbibed all these values and ideas and you know, could also be prominent despite not having gone for the Hajj. Mm-hmm. There was a sort of flattening quality to the Hajj for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, dressed the same way in a place with other people. All Muslims, and upon coming back, you could see how this sort of economic and political and social stratification would not sit well with them, with these returnees from the Hajj.
Right.
Of all ethnicities, Arabs, Indians, and Malays, they were very critical of this sort of rifts within the community already. But then, as I said, it took on another color when the question of Malay / Muslim became an issue.
Right.
So, you know,
so that was going to be my next question. I mean, where does this arise from? Is it also a side effect of the reformist movement, or is there another source for this increasing ethnic tension?
Yeah, I think it might be linked,
mm-hmm.
but it's definitely not the only source. It's definitely not entirely religious, because people who were Malay nationalists, you know, during this period were not entirely religious themselves.
Right.
So they might have been influenced. They might have ridden the wave of critique, but definitely not tied to it solely. There was also more of a political consciousness that arose during this interwar period,
mm-hmm.
Due to what happened in the First World War,
yes.
You know, in Europe and also in Southeast Asia, where it was being played out, and so, you know, those were also, I would say, more powerful, stronger factors in this rise of Malay nationalism.
Right. Is there a point where these people become where they start identifying as, say, Malayan or Singaporean as opposed to Muslim or Malay? Mm. Is there a point where that identity, you know, we can see that identity arise?
So yeah, it's a very interesting question. And as a historian, I did want to trace this shift, and I tried. But what I found was that they tend to code switch, you know. Right. So when it came to talking to about Singaporean or Malaysian or Malayan politics, they would identify themselves as Malays. They would usually be the representative of the Malay community anyway. So, you know, they didn't even have to assert that so much sometimes. And then when it came to dealing with their fellow Arabs or Indians, they would identify themselves as Arabs and Indians and so on and so forth. Yeah. So it's not, I didn't see a shift. They would identify as both at the same time. They would identify as Malay and also as Arabs and, you know, all at the same time. Right. Yeah, depending on who they were talking to.
Right.
Yeah.
But in their actions, they were investing in Singapore.
So territorially, there's definitely a clear shift. They became increasingly more and more invested in Southeast Asia over time.
Earlier, you said something very interesting about returnees from the Hajj being more disapproving of this economic stratification. Now, one interesting thing that we see happen in the rest of the East Indies, of course, is the rise of radical socialism, right? But why does it not really then take hold in Malaya? It's very strange that these two regions right next to each other develop so differently. You know, Tan Malaka, for example, in visiting Singapore in the 30s, got really frustrated because he could not find radicals among the Malays and ended up working with the Chinese instead. So why is it we don't see a parallel of, say, how the underground communist movement in Indonesia works with the Red Sharikat Islam? Why is there no parallel to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you pointed that out. It is a question that has puzzled historians. And I think that, and no one has come up with a convincing argument yet. But I think that it's because, you know, they were very much tied to the state. You know, they were very much tied to the British colonial state. And their fortunes were a result of their close alliance with the state, you know, and the state being a British colonial state.
Right.
And so, you know, it's a tall order to move from that to allying with people on the other side of the spectrum, I think.
What leads to the formation of the Kesatuan Melayu Singapura by Muhammad Yunus? How would you characterize that organization? Is it a nationalist organization or chiefly a Malay one?
Well, it was a Malay organization, and it was inclusive. It was not exclusive, in the sense that they didn't cut out people of DKK or DKAs, you know, and they embodied what the Malays today would consider an ideal Malay movement, in that it's inclusive. So historically, the region, the Malay world has been a very hospitable host to people from the outside, and this is the narrative that is often spread by Malays of a certain bent, you know, as being, you know, anyone could be Malay, you know, if you speak Malay and stuff like that, you could be Malay. So it's a very interesting turn, I would say. And this very association that you mentioned, Kesatuan Melayu, would embody that ideal, you know. But at the same time, this ideal, this narrative of an ideal is a political tool, because, you know, it legitimizes people who were not what we would call really Malay, people who were of Arab and Indian descent or Chinese descent. They would now be considered Malay. You know what I mean? At other times, however, they would not be considered Malay. So there's this question about how, you know, why are, I mean, there's this age-old question which historians ask, in that why is it that the Arabs coming from so far away, fewer in number, less problematically regarded as either Bumiputra in Indonesia and Malaysia or Malay in Malaysia and also Singapore than, say, the Chinese, right, who also frequently intermarried with local populations in Indonesia and Malaysia, but are always regarded as foreign. Like, why are the Arabs and, to some extent, also the Indian Muslims more welcome into this category of Malay than the Chinese, who have also been here in Southeast Asia for centuries?
Right.
So one thing that has been argued is that these Arabs were already have an exalted status within a hierarchy of the Muslim world.
Right.
And they were Muslims, you know, and so they were more, you know, naturally included within the Malay world, mm-hmm. which is predominantly Muslim. But that being said, you know, there are Chinese Muslims who have also not been welcomed into this category of Malay or Bumiputra,
yeah.
you know, and one might argue that the Chinese influence in Southeast Asia, Chinese Muslim influence in Southeast Asia has been around for longer than Muslim influence from South Asia and the Middle East. And so, you know, it's a very interesting, complicated and fraught issue, and most of it rests on you know, political exigencies.
Mm. Al Iman in 1906 is I understand it's a newspaper that what was the role of the media, the press, in sort of giving birth to Malay nationalism?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. The reformist movements spread ideas mostly through the press. So the printing press played a huge role in the spread of reformist ideas. And Al Iman, I would say, is the most prominent periodical that came out at the time. It was based on Al Manar, which came out of Cairo. It was actually a direct copy of Al Manar. It often reprinted articles in Al Manar, actually. And it was very much against, you know, the superstition of the Malay community and stuff like that. And it was also critical of practices which veered on the dualization of God, you know,
right.
Talismans and stuff like that. So the printing press definitely played a huge role in the spread of reformist movements. Yeah, and periodicals were mushroomed, but also went out of circulation really quickly. So there were periodicals that only lasted for two issues and stuff like that. And you can find all these periodicals in the National Library, which collected each copy of each issue that was ever printed in Singapore.
Oh. Yeah. Which language are they in?
They are in Malay.
Okay, and the script?
Written in Arabic script.
Right.
Yeah, in Jawi.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a little difficult to access for the rest of us.
Yeah, but they're very interesting. Mm. Very interesting. And some of these, most of these periodicals, they didn't have bylines. So when you know, when they wrote critiques, it could be very scathing and they didn't have to hold back because they would not be accountable for what they've written, or they would have like a pseudonym, you know.
Okay, so they were almost completely anonymous. It wasn't
almost,
like
we it
know
seems that way.
It was from a pool of people.
So we know who they are.
Okay.
Yeah, we know. We know who they are.
Right.
Yeah, and their contemporaries will also know who they are.
Okay.
But, you know, within this society, there will be 8 to 10 people who could be potential suspects. And so, you know, it's not... So again, accountability was not imminent, you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
At the time. Yeah. And one could see what one could see what kinds of practices were prevalent at the time based on what was criticized at any particular time from 1906 till 1928, for example. You know, different practices tended to be vilified.
So thank you very much. That has been great. I have learned so much today, and I'm sure the listeners have too.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's been really enjoyable.
As always, if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, please email thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit our website at thehistoryofsingapore.com. Thanks very much, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.